From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The NCAA votes to provide significant autonomy to 65 colleges that are members of five wealthy and powerful athletic conferences, and UT Austin places a hold on a controversial proposal to charge Uber users of network bandwidth extra fees for access to the campus network. This is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comment section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation today with the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association. At a meeting on Thursday, August 7th, the NCAA Division I Board of Directors adopted new rules and regulations that would provide significant levels of autonomy for the 65 campuses that are members of the Power Five sports conferences: the Atlantic Coast Conference, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-12, and the Southeastern Conference. The new rules cover such things as student stipends, better or more meals for athletes, better health insurance, and guaranteed four-year scholarships. The NCAA argues that high-revenue conferences and campuses are best able to implement reforms that will benefit their athletes. Critics say the new rules will create a super division that will ratchet up spending on sports in ways that give them an even bigger competitive advantage over the rest, widening the gap between the haves and the have-nots in big-time college sports. Joining us are Donna Lopiano, former director of women's athletics at UT Austin and now the president of Sports Management Resources, and Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Donna, let me turn to you. You've been on, one sense, both sides of these issues. You have been an athletic director at a large school that's part of that watches this. You are now doing work in this area. Who are the winners and losers in this conversation and in terms of these new NCAA regulations?
Well, there are two issues here. The winners and losers are the student-athletes and the non-Big Five conference member institutions of the NCAA. But let's be clear that even prior to this action, which kind of established another subdivision of Division I that is going to be allowed to pass special rules, the NCAA in 1998 took the big step by giving FBS institutions organizational control, by giving them a majority rule on the executive committee of the NCAA, and on the Division I Board of Directors, giving them majority rule. They established a plutocracy, and there's no other sport organization in the world, including the NFL and the NBA, who lets the minority of the richest owners determine the rules of the game.
Let's go back to the student side of that, because you also mentioned that you thought that students might be losers in this new initiative.
Oh, absolutely. Think of what's happening here. The FBS, by virtue of their control of the organization, the NCAA, prevents the NCAA from establishing a competing national championship in football to the current college football playoff. The college football playoff is owned by the FBS conferences outside of the NCAA. Thus, that money for that national championship, what is going to be a 14 playoff this fall, is flowing only to these FBS conferences. 75% of that $440 million is going to the Big Five conferences, 25% to the remainder. So what, in effect, the Big Five is doing is saying, I'm going to take care of my kids, but I'm not going to take care of all the kids in Division I. If the NCAA owned that $440 million, it could be distributed like the Final Four is to benefit all the athletes in Division I. Not to extend too long, but that $440 million could buy athletic injury insurance for every one of the 450,000 NCAA athletes. It could buy the cost of attendance increases in athletic scholarships for every Division I athlete. It could buy an academic trust fund to allow every Division I athlete who doesn't complete a degree access to financial support after they complete their eligibility. But the Big Five is being selfish about this. They're saying, no, we're only going to keep this money for ourselves.
Doug, this does seem to be a conversation about money, as Donna indicated. A recent NCAA report reveals that median spending on football at the universities at the top of the sports pyramid is about $62.3 million, up from $28.9 million a decade ago. These same campuses now spend a median of $75,000 per student football player, aside from the academic cost of having that student on campus, compared to $41,000 10 years ago. Moreover, even as campuses say football and basketball revenues help support other sports, only 20% of Division I athletic programs cover their expenses from sport revenues, such as tickets, TV licensing, and licensing of logos. Money? At the heart of this?
Of course. I mean, right now, to listen to these 65 schools, they say, and they're under intense pressure right now to show that they can and will do more for athletes. And I don't doubt that they will do some of the things they are going to do in the first actions when they have this newfound authority is to provide some extra benefits to the athletes that are in those schools. And that's good, and they're under intense pressure to do so. But it's a little hard. You can be forgiven some skepticism, as some members of Congress have, that this group of schools are going to be agents of sort of reform, and because particularly when it comes to curtailing spending or elevating the primacy of academics, because history has shown that they've been the drivers of the trends you just pointed out. I mean, most of the reason that we've seen the spending on football and basketball particularly ratchet up so much is because of those schools. And so the idea that they're going to somehow pull back, and the list of issues that they have authority over includes some things that suggest that they might be cutting back, and it's just kind of hard to believe that. What's happening here is a sort of a continuation of a long history of NCAA governance where a smaller and smaller group of schools get more and more authority, and in general they do so to try and give themselves more distance between them and everybody else, and that's we're going to see a continuation of a different sort of separation between the haves and the have-nots here.
Don, I want to come back to something you said earlier about the plutocracy. While there's been a lot of attention focused on the potential benefits to students, the fact that they might get stipends, they might get health insurance, one of the big issues in these new Division I governing structure is the disproportionate power, the fact that these 65 campuses that represent about one-fifth of the Division I campuses will have about 37, almost 40% of the voting power on the Division I board. Would you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Well, it's the reason why the membership who voted on this gave this power to the FBS originally, and now more power to the Big Five conferences, is because of the bullying tactics of the Big Five or the FBS. They have historically threatened to leave the NCAA if the membership didn't give them what they wanted. And so the membership, which cares about every athlete's expenses being paid to national championships, whether it's Division I, II, or III, or the membership in Division I really caring about that Final Four money coming back, and if this group of institutions leaves, they're going to undermine the value of the Final Four championship. And even the non-Big Five FBS conferences, they're getting bought off. They're going to get an increase of maybe 15% from what they previously got with this new playoff largesse. So it has been a intentional bullying of the membership and an embarrassing response of the membership that won't put their foot down.
And Donna, just for clarification, for those of us who aren't immersed in the politics of the NCAA, you've alluded several times to FBS. Could you just clarify what that means?
Yeah, the Division I has three pieces to it. There are the football playing members, of the biggest schools in the country, about 121 institutions. And the Big Five conferences are about half of those 121 institutions. That is the Football Bowl subdivision. Then there's a Football Championship subdivision, which is other football-playing schools in Division I that make a lesser commitment to football. They have a national championship already, the NCAA National Championship. And the remainder of Division I, about 100 schools or so, is basketball-only institutions. They don't play football at all.
All right, let's talk about the student side of this. So again, there's been a lot of attention about potential student benefits, stipends, health insurance.
Only for the students at those 65 institutions.
Only for those 65. And one of the critiques that seems to be emerging in some of the coverage of this is that, in fact, while there may be benefits to students, they also may become further isolated from other students on campus. We know that at many campuses, in addition to special facilities for training, students often have access to special tutors and other benefits. Will this, at these 65 campuses, lead to even more isolation of the student athletes from their peers? Donna?
No question. There's no question at all. What the FBS institutions have used their largesse for, because that's not controlled by the NCAA like the Final Four money, is to pad coaches' salaries. You've got 300 FBS coaches now, either FBS institution coaches in basketball and football, who are making $1 million or more. You're looking at athletic directors who typically are making salaries in the Big Five conferences, for sure, between $500,000 and $1 million apiece. Commissioners of those conferences that are making over $1 million apiece. Lavish facilities that are restricted to athletes. They don't allow other students into the game room, into the special computer facility. And, you know, where training tables have been limited in the past, you can see a reopening of all the training tables. You're going to see a reopening of the treatment of athletes as a privileged class that will further distance them from normal students.
And Doug, as an observer, what does this do for recruiting? I mean, you think about these 65 schools that may be able to offer cash stipends above scholarships. How badly does that tilt the recruiting activities on behalf of the 65?
Well, I think that's what I said before about sort of the greater separation between the haves and the have-nots. Donna's right that use of this money, the Big Five conferences themselves say is that the reason there has been all this money flowing into these non-athlete things is because they have been restricted from increasing spending benefits to athletes, and there is some evidence of that. I mean, the one of the genesis of this change was that there was a proposal, there was a vote a couple of years ago to increase the essentially the value of the scholarship, and it was fought by some of the rest of Division I. But there is so you know, at their word, there is some truth to what they're saying in terms of what they want, some of what they want to do with this newfound authority. But there is. It is again. It's given history. It's sort of impossible to believe that they're not also going to do a whole bunch of things that give themselves a competitive edge. And yes, if they give a more valuable scholarship, it's going to increase their competitive edge over everybody else. And I just wanted to sort of say one thing. Donna is absolutely right that the threat of withdrawal by sort of the biggest powers has been this sort of sword hanging over the NCAA. And there's a part of me that sort of wishes the rest of the NCAA and the rest of Division I would sort of let them walk. I mean, because I think those schools in many ways need the rest of the NCAA as much as the NCAA seems to feel it needs them. Those schools are able right now to cloak themselves in the idea that this is still an amateur enterprise, and the if they walked out on their own and sort of walked away from Division III and from the Ivy League and sort of the other places that conduct sports closer to the original amateur model, I think they might very quickly find themselves sort of killing the goose that laid the golden egg by finding themselves taxed and all sorts of things that are unintended consequences. So I guess I'm not 100% sure that the sports powers have quite the threat. I mean, that the threat is as real as they make it seem. And I think we're headed in a, this is just another step. And I think eventually 5 years from now, there'll be something else and they probably will threaten to walk away again. And at some point I would love to see love to see them try.
I concur with Doug. I really do. But, and I think you should really understand that what's preventing them from doing so is not only the fear that Congress is going to remove their tax preferences or start treating them like professional sports, but there are like 20 antitrust suits right now against the NCAA. Mm-hmm. And where the antitrust suits go is after the money. And if the money goes with the Big Five conferences, all of those lawsuits, you know, they're right in the crosshairs of financial debilitation of a magnitude they've never considered. And Doug is right. They're hiding behind the 1,000 institutions right now, and I'm with him. Let them go and see what happens.
Donna, let's talk very quickly about one of those lawsuits playing out in San Francisco, and that's about licensing royalties and student images and numbers. Campuses make and the NCAA make a lot of money when the names of prominent athletes are attached to jerseys and logo items and then sold. There's been some issues as well about images, whether they're named or not in computer games. What happens is, as this case goes through the courts, assuming that the athletes win?
Well, I think if the athletes win, the issue becomes, and this is kind of not part of the O'Bannon case, but it will be part of the other cases coming down, is I don't think there's any question that the athletes are going to win in terms of use of their names, images, and likenesses post-eligibility. The big issue that has to be litigated on point is whether or not they need to get paid for the use of their names, images, and likenesses for regular season athletic events or postseason championships during their eligibility. Who owns that? You know, is it because of the Texas on your jersey or your name on the back? You know, who owns this animal? And there's where I think, you know, Congress is probably going to come in eventually to tease out those nuances, giving the athlete the rights he deserves for name and image post eligibility, but leaving the institutions for regular season eligibility.
Great.
Do you agree on that, Doug? Do you think that?
I think that is going to be the key issue. I don't know how. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV, so I can't say where it's going to go. But I think these legal threats are real. Some of them are going to really hit the NCAA hard, I think it's going to be really difficult for the big time college sports enterprise to sort of protect itself against this set of legal challenges.
And we haven't even seen the concussion lawsuits start to kick in yet, like they have for the NFL. So there's a lot of financial liability here that isn't being factored in to what the Big Five is doing right now. And they're already spending the $440 million that starts this year. And let's be honest with each other. You know, it's only a matter of time before that 14 playoff becomes an $8 billion property. So it's going to take off really quickly from here.
Great. Donald Lopiano and Doug Letterman, thank you very much for the engaging conversation and the analysis of what's going on with Division I NCAA teams and the new regulations. We continue our conversation today talking about bandwidth fees and the end of internet entitlements. Last week, the University of Texas at Austin announced plans to charge special internet access fees to Uber users, primarily students who consume lots of bandwidth on their multiple internet devices, laptops, tablets, mobile phones, and gaming devices. The proposal, now on hold for further review, has been a catalyst for lots of discussion among and beyond the campus IT community about how to address the rising demand for bandwidth, how to cover the costs associated with the rising demand, and the difference, if any, between academic work and watching Netflix on campus networks. Some, and this observer included, see the UT Austin discussion as the beginning of the end of what might be called internet entitlements, unlimited, unrestricted, and unquestioned access to wired and wireless campus networks. Joining us for this conversation are Lev Gonick, who's the CEO of One Community in Northeastern Ohio, based in Cleveland, and the former CIO and Vice President for Information Technology at Case Western Reserve University. And continuing is Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Lev, let me turn to you. What's this about? Is this a conversation about bandwidth? Is it a conversation about money? What are the issues at play in this conversation at UT Austin?
Casey, I think the real issue is actually about organizational culture and the broader culture on the campus. In the main, this is not a question about finance. You can do the numbers yourself and realize that the kinds of caps that are in play or proposed in play at UT Austin and also being considered at many other campuses, and indeed in place for as much as a decade of many other campuses, is really whether or not the culture of the organization is and supports fees, caps, and subscription services, and whether this is just one more way of generating a little bit of additional fee without taking on the broader question about redistributing budgets within IT or having IT being held accountable by the broader campus for maintaining all services currently in its portfolio.
So, Lev, help us put this a little bit in context. The fee structure at UT Austin, as posted on the web, suggests for the true Uber users, students who might consume as much as 50 gigabytes a week. Put that in contrast where lots of family plans for mobile phones are 10 gigabytes a month. The 50 gigabytes a week, the additional cost to a student might be $50 or $60 for an academic year. What does 50 or 60 gigabytes look like?
Well, it basically looks like about one DVD worth of video content per day in that week. And, you know, right away we want to go to the idea that bandwidth is constrained. Again, I think that that is not necessarily the case. Again, I think it's about organizational culture. We can talk more about that. I think really the question is, whether or not this is a opportunity for a little bit of additional revenue coming into an IT organization. Once upon a time, we had dollars coming in for long distance. Those went away. Then we had opportunities for technology fees in campus in general, and certainly among the large research universities, and certainly among the privates. Those are less and less acceptable because students believe they're already paying essentially market rates for their academic experiences and all related services. And now, again, I think it's a marginal new dollar that's available that only works if the culture of the organization already supports fees, or as apparently is the case, some reconsideration at UT Austin, because perhaps it is beginning to fly in the face of other values and considerations around fees on campus.
Doug, there's a whole conversation that's been going on for more than a decade about academic, the use of campus networks for non-academic work. We certainly saw this when the Recording Industry of America and the Motion Picture Association of America urged on congressional critics to go after college and university officials about the illegal peer-to-peer downloading of music and movies on campus networks. Set a context for this. I mean, is this really an issue? Well, in the past we've historically just said, let people loose on the network, whatever the activity might be and whatever they're downloading and whatever they're doing, whether it's academic or not.
Right. I really defer to Lev and other technology experts on. I'm interested to hear him say that he generally doesn't think bandwidth is the issue, because if that's the case, then it really is about sort of changing behavior on campus. I think there's no question we're seeing attempts to try to differentiate between different kinds of usage, and I'm really intrigued by Lev's point that this is really about changing culture. I think that's pretty consistent with some non-technology efforts we've seen. Penn State imposing health insurance fees on faculty and staff to try to change behaviors. Lincoln University a few years ago putting in requirements that are to try to change student behavior in terms of obesity. I think it's dangerous or risky for institutions to be some of the first out of the gate, or at least the first to try these things. I'd love to hear Lev talk a little bit more, maybe offline, about some of the that he thinks this is happening lots of other places, because we haven't seen that yet. But I think there is a real sense that students want, or that institutions want to retain their networks for the things that are most fundamental to the campus. But at a lot of these campuses, the institutions are turning to they're serving lots of purposes for students, and they're trying to be the students are living in their dorms and needing entertainment as well. So I think I don't know how campuses are going to differentiate among those, but I think we're going to see lots of experimentation along these lines.
Casey, if I could just jump in.
You've been a CIO at two institutions. You've seen this up close and personal in terms of the responsibilities of the CIO and providing bandwidth to campus users. How big of an issue is this in terms of the academic versus non-academic use?
Right. The largest use of a campus network typically is between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. That's when students in their residence halls are actually consuming resources. But the university's network manager actually doesn't dial up and dial down bandwidth through the 24 hours a day. It's essentially a resource that is subscribed to at a certain level 24 hours a day, 365 days in the year. And therefore, typically, what happens is that use shifts from, if you will, traditional campus and academic use, whatever exactly that means, to a combination of academic and leisurely use of network resources in the evening. And I think that, in reality, therefore, it's not additive. That is to say, the entertainment use of the network or the leisurely use of the network is not actually additive on top of the academic use. It's actually distributed across the 24 hours in the day. And again, I think largely it is about trying to encourage modified behavior, not to do less leisurely work, but to realize that it's a kind of copay. If you're going to be consuming this resource, I actually don't think over the long haul that when Netflix and Hulu and now Amazon are providing essentially as much as you can drink, or in this case, as much as you can consume at a fixed cost, that campuses are going to find a student willingness to consume this on a subscription basis without at least some pushback. Again, I think it's all about culture at UT Austin, at Cornell, and elsewhere where there have been these efforts to constrain or put caps. It's about culture. If there already are fees, it's typically just seen as one more. If it becomes more than a nuisance, you get pushback. And again, I think the local drama will unfold in UT Austin accordingly.
But Doug, what about off-campus critics who go after campuses for creating plush student environments, whether it's athletic facilities, whether it's the stuff that typical students might use in gyms and the health clubs and climbing walls, the fact that the campus is supporting unlimited, if you will, consumer or leisurely or recreational internet access as part of the student fee, and particularly for public institutions like UT Austin. Are campuses just opening themselves up for even more criticism from outside sources?
Well, I think when you made the point before that the fee is on top of what are steadily increasing tuitions generally, and I think that's part of the problem here, is that we've seen campuses try to shift, and Lev's right that these dollar figures are not big, and we quoted students in the story saying, listen, they want to charge us a little more, but it's a whole lot better than what I'd pay for a provider back home. But people are, I think campuses have set themselves up for a problem by saying we're giving you lots of amenities and we're charging you a pretty penny in a lot of cases for that. And then to be charging on top of that, I think that's some of the pushback we saw. Some of the other pushback we saw that we haven't mentioned yet is there's a bit of a conflict here with campuses that are generally in the sort of public domain pushing back against net neutrality and sort of the push by to sort of differentiate the speeds of different kinds of web traffic at sort of a national federal level. And seeing there's a sense of a little bit of hypocrisy here in some quarters that on individual on their own campuses they're starting to do that differentiation. And I think that's another element of this that we haven't mentioned yet.
Lev Gonick, is the net neutrality analogy a fair one? There is some differentiation. Of course, the public conversation about net neutrality through the FCC has been about fees for the content providers to get faster distribution of their stuff. In the case of UT Austin and campuses, it's where particularly Austin said, well, we're going to put people into a slower network if they hit their cap each week. It's about issues for the consumers, but still, does the analogy hold in this conversation?
I actually don't think it does. It's perhaps a bit nuanced, but as you outlined, the specifics around net neutrality have to do with relationships between content and distribution. Campuses typically with very large broadband infrastructure aren't all that concerned about sort of fast lanes and slow lanes for content distribution, peering relationships that campus networks and our research and education networks across the country have with content providers like Netflix and Hulu and others really means that it's a fairly efficient distribution from those content players. This really is a conversation about culture and capping and whether or not culture and capping at this campus is something that is just one more fee or whether or not it is a new kind of concern that will have to work itself out on the campus or within the local context. I again, myself don't see the value of trying to conflate the conversation around network neutrality. Campuses are among the very best in the world when it comes to the commitments to the open internet and to the philosophy of open, unbiased access to network resources.
So very quickly as we close, is this the beginning of the end of internet entitlements, or is this a tempest in a teapot? From each of you, first Lev, tempest in a teapot, or the beginning of the end of entitlement?
I think it's noise right now. I think it is, again, probably going to get played out on each campus in terms of its own culture related to fees, which is one of those permanent debates on campus right alongside parking.
Doug, tempest in a teapot, or the beginning of the end of internet entitlements?
I think we'll see more campuses try to experiment. Again, I think it's when you're one of the first out of the gate, or at least one of the first sort of to go public and get sort of get pushback on it, I think places will probably, we probably will see people pull back a little bit, and then a few months from now, we'll see others try it. I think we'll see it spread. I think we'll see it's a tempest at UT Austin that we'll see spread elsewhere.
Great. My thanks to you both, Lev Gonick, CEO of One Community, and Doug Letterman from Inside Higher Ed. Thank you for joining us this week, and our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our conversations. Lev Gonick, CEO of One Community in Cleveland, Ohio, and Donna Lopiano, President of Sports Management Resources. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio streamer podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.